Welcome to Girls on Pop. I am your co-host, Marie Antunes, joined today by fellow co-host.
I am Ashley Lynch.
And Ashley, where can people find you?
Best place to find me is probably on Twitter at Ashley Lynch.
And you can also find me on the Twitters at The Marina. But we have a lot to cover, so we're going to jump right in. We're going to forgo the niceties and talk about the disaster.
No niceties, only meanities.
The dumpster fire that is Netflix. No, I'm kidding. But can we talk a little bit about, you suggested that we discuss this, the Netflix earnings call and the fallout from that, which is both amusing and not.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting story. And I think it's, I think people are also reading the story the wrong way. But the big thing that came out was basically Netflix had their quarterly shareholders meeting and basically announced that they have, they lost 200,000 subscribers in the first 3 months of this year. And they're also expecting to lose 2 million more subscribers in the next quarter. So, of course, that's like kind of huge. That's like, you know, 2.2 million subscribers. That's a lot of subscribers. So that's like obviously a big deal. But I think people are also overreacting to this. I've been seeing a lot of people treating this like this is the fall of Netflix. They're finally getting what's coming to them. This will teach them for canceling the OA, you know, or what insert show that everyone's mad got canceled after season two, because that's the joke. Netflix cancels everything after two seasons. So this isn't good for Netflix. But at the same time, if you look at the streaming market, Netflix, even after losing 2.2 million subscribers, is still the top of the streaming platform, and by a pretty significant margin. Disney Plus is doing really good too, and is trailing just like not far behind Netflix, but far enough behind that this does not put Disney in first place. And then after Disney, it's a real steep drop off before you get to number three. You know, the places where Paramount Plus and HBO Max are sitting, it's about half of what Disney Plus has. So Netflix is not going away anytime soon. But this definitely is like, you know, they've taken one on the chin.
For sure. I kind of had the same feeling. I'm like, wow, you guys are really overreacting about the fact that they're losing 2.2 million subscribers. Because like you say, the race, there kind of is no race at this point. I mean, like you say, it's close between Disney and Netflix, but still far enough away that that Netflix continues to be the powerhouse of the streaming platforms. I think for me, the more interesting part of that discussion was the shakeup that came after the announcement. So clearly, I mean, Netflix has known about these numbers for a long time, or at least for a while, and they've had time to process. I thought it was unfortunate that they chose a similar timeline to make the announcement about the shakeups at Netflix Animation. I mean, last year, Netflix Animation was kind of like it was kind of like the rainbow halls of animation. They basically brought under their wing all of the major like creators. They had everybody doing a show or a movie for Netflix. It was kind of seen as this hallowed place where you could bring your pet project and Netflix would help you make it, and you'd have like full creative control. And that did happen for a number of shows and a number of films. I mean, we've got Trollhunters out of that. We've got My End of Three out of that. There was Over the Moon came out of that. Like, there was, like, just the slew of animation that came out of that project was mind-blowing. And, I mean, the shows that came out of that as well, like Arcane and God knows whatever else. Like, I don't even watch all of them, but there's so many. So the fact that there was this massive shakeup at animation and so many projects were canceled and so many creators left, tied into, like, kind of in parallel with the news about the subscriber drop, felt like really poor timing and, like, a real marketing fail on Netflix's part. they could have maybe spaced out those announcements because it really felt like
kind of locked into when the shareholders meeting is going to happen and when that information can come out because it's a publicly traded company, so they can't really stop that part of it from
coming. No, they can't, but they could have. I think the timing for the animation thing could have been handled better because it did feel like all of a sudden everything at Netflix is just going sideways, and it didn't help the news about the subscriber drop. I mean, to me, it's like, I'm not going anywhere. Netflix is still probably, if I was to cancel any subscription service that I have, Netflix would probably be like the last thing I would consider canceling my subscription to, just because there's so much variety. But I think that the fact that they're finally clamping down on people sharing passwords is probably a good move, strategically speaking. I mean, maybe you should have done that a long time ago. I don't know.
You know, that's where they're focusing their attention, is on the shared password thing. And I'm not sure it's actually as, like, significant problem as they pretend it to be. I think it makes a very easy scapegoat in the same way that, you know, that it's really easy to point at online piracy and saying, this is the reason why our movies fail. And they're like, no, there's movies that succeed and, you know, they have the same amount of piracy. So it's like, it's the people who are sharing a password on Netflix aren't likely to be, you know, signing up for an account in lieu of, like, not being able to have that password. There's a reason they're sharing it. So I don't think it's as big a deal as they're making it out to be. But I do think that this might actually, or hopefully, will end up changing a little bit the approach that Netflix takes towards the movies and shows that they produce. Because up until this point, or at least for the last considerable while, Netflix has sort of taken the shotgun approach where it's like, let's just produce a lot of content and some of it will hit. And for every Squid Game we get, there's like 300 things that no one even knows even exist. And they produce a lot of content. And they're, you know, fairly hands-off for the most part with the people that create stuff for them. So in lieu of working for smaller budgets, you get creative control, and that's what makes Netflix attractive to creators. But Netflix ends up being in the business of just creating massive amounts of content. It becomes the streaming service that you fold laundry to and cook dinner to, instead of something that becomes a destination for stuff you want to sit down and watch. And that was fine when Netflix was the only real contender on the streaming market, but that's no longer the case. You got HBO Max, which is putting a lot of, like, great first-run content up there, along with, like, the movies. You have stuff like Peacemaker, shows like that. You've got Disney Plus, which is doing all the Marvel shows and the Star Wars shows. And at the end of the day, Netflix doesn't have a Mandalorian. They don't have a Peacemaker. It's like the biggest thing they've got is like Stranger Things at this point, which is winding down. And the occasional Squid Game, which is like a genuine phenomenon that no one predicted was going to be as huge as it is. And so I think Netflix is going to have to start to reassess how it is they choose the project that they choose, and maybe putting in a little bit more work into shepherding them into being big kind of event shows and movies that will drive people to be like, yes, I gotta see this thing on Netflix. Because right now it's just like, throw as much as you can at the wall and see what sticks. And I think they end up producing a lot of stuff that no one would ever miss.
Well, okay, so you have a great point there, because I think you nailed it in the fact that they've produced so much stuff, like half the time I don't even know. Like, there's so much new stuff, you can't even watch all of it. My one caveat to that is that that means that there's also a lot of stuff that gets produced that generally would never get made that I will actually watch. Mm-hmm. And so, like, there's a niche market for some of the content that they produce that nobody else would touch with a 10-foot pole. But because Netflix kind of, you know, is willing to take a gamble and hope that something hits, we get to see stuff that maybe wouldn't get made otherwise. So, I mean, it is kind of like a give and take, but I think you're right. And I mean, they do need to be a little more discerning in the content that they're putting their muscle behind. I don't know if they maybe need to also rethink their marketing strategy, because sometimes there's projects that, you know, they start promoting a month before they're on the website. So it's like you don't even know something is coming until you see a trailer for it and it's out in 4 weeks. And then you miss it and the next thing is coming in 4 weeks. So you never get to watch it. I guess that goes back to that there's so much content that, you know, maybe it's that, too much.
Yeah, that's always been one of my big complaints about Netflix, is I don't think they do a really good job at advertising their content. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of times there's something on Netflix and I don't even know it's there. I will discover it completely by accident months later. It's like, how long has this been here? Oh, it came out in December.
Yeah.
You know, and it's extremely frustrating. And that's what you get with the amount of content that they produce. And you're right. We would, if Netflix goes to a more discerning model, we're going to lose some of those more unique films and shows that, you know, you probably wouldn't get otherwise. But you'd probably also have a lot of those shows not canceled after season two, which is also the big bane and frustration of Netflix. Is every time I see a conversation come up about shows on Netflix online, I hear constantly from people about how they refuse to get invested in any show on Netflix because they know it's going to get canceled before it ends. And I feel that pain. I understand it. I get it. At the same time, you know, take a chance on a great show and enjoy what you get. It's not like we haven't had, in the entire history of television, shows being canceled before they got a chance to end. I'm sorry, this is just how TV has worked since TV existed. You know, so it's like, let's grow up on that one a little bit. But, Where was I going to go with this? Oh, yeah. Netflix did in the past, they tried to go the more discerning route and started to woo filmmakers who would actually draw people into the platform. David Fincher has managed to stick around, but he was one of those guys that they early on courted into trying to make stuff, and we got like House of Cards out of that, and
Mindhunter, which is
the Wachowskis, and we got Sense8, and Baz Luhrmann to do the what was the name of his show? I can't remember. Was it The Beatdown?
I don't remember.
I'm blanking. People are yelling at me right now. But they did put in to like try to create like prestige level television shows on Netflix, and what they found out is that it's really fucking expensive to do that, to create like these prestige shows. And after that, they pulled back and said, well, instead of making these prestige shows that don't set the world on fire, why don't we instead just like spend less money making a lot of shows and like, you know, just fire scattershot with this. And I think that's been to Netflix's detriment on a quality level. I kind of wish they would go back to that that older model. And they're also competing now with platforms that don't have to earn a profit, because they get their profit in other places. Disney Plus is not going to run out of money because it is Disney. Amazon Prime is not going to run out of money because it's Amazon. And the only thing they're doing is acquiring more and more, Amazon having recently bought MGM. You know, so that is the playing field that Netflix owned for the longest time. And now people who don't have to worry about whether or not they're marking a loss every year are coming and trying to own the landscape from Netflix. So they kind of have to step up their game and compete with those other streaming services on the level that they are providing. Otherwise, they're going to slowly start to see what they've got chipped away more and more and more until they are in the number three spot.
Yeah, You're 110% right. 110% right.
I mean, I hope that having that extra 10% of being right. It makes me feel so good.
I mean, that is the reality of it. Like you say, they're now competing against other organizations that make the bulk of their money in some other way, and they're not reliant solely on movie making. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I'm still not super worried about this downfall in numbers, but it'll be interesting to see what other fallout comes from that, because I'm sure there will be more.
But if Netflix does manage to recover and rebuild from this, it's a good time to buy Netflix stock.
You know what? We looked. It's still way out of my price range. I did look.
I am very tempted because it is the lowest it has been in 4 years.
Yeah, if that's right. I mean, if you have the money and you want to buy into Netflix, now would definitely be the good time to do it. But it was still sitting, I think when I looked on Friday, it was sitting at $264 US. So that's still a little bit out of my price range. I need a sugar daddy, apparently. Well, let's talk about some movies, shall we?
Yeah.
Let's talk about, for us, what is maybe the biggest opening of the weekend, maybe not for everybody else, but The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
Yes, because it marks the second film that we have managed to be able to go see in the theater together.
And not just that. I mean, admittedly, I'll talk about the other big movie that opened this weekend, though neither movie was the box office winner of the weekend. Let's be totally clear, that went to the animated movie, The Bad Guys. However,
which, that's shocker.
I know, right? It does look like it'll be a lot of fun. I'll get to that eventually, but it just wasn't in the cards for the weekend. But so let's talk about the Nick Cage movie where Nick Cage plays a version of Nick Cage.
Yeah, this movie was so interesting. I was like, when I first heard about this movie, I was like, I don't know, that sounds kind of narcissistic and up its own ass and so meta and post-ironic that it's just painful. And then I saw the trailer, and I was like, that actually looks pretty funny. And then we went to go see it, and the movie is very funny.
Okay, were we the only ones laughing in the theater, though? Because I don't think anybody was having as much fun as we were.
Well, there wasn't that many people in the theater, so it's we saw it on a Thursday night, and it was pretty slim pickings, so we had the place mostly to ourselves. But the entire premise is basically just Nick Cage is playing Nick Cage, and he is basically at a low point in his career, and he's offered $1 million to go do a birthday party on some rich guy's island, who happens to be Pedro Pascal, and is just like a giant Nick Cage super fan, and they hit it off and become basically best friends. And then it gets pulled into a potential CIA plot involving a kidnapping. And it's like, this movie literally has everything. It's a comedy, it's a satire, it's action, it's spy thriller. You know, there's literally not a genre this film does not touch.
So true. Family drama. It's all in here, people. It's all in here. I'm a really big fan of JCVD. I really like that movie and I like the concept a lot. And this feels very much in that vein. I read somewhere that Nicolas Cage actually turned this role down like 7 times before he actually signed on to the project because he thought the same thing, that like nobody would want to see him play a version of himself.
I can see that.
Me too. In the end, I'm with you. I think it's very, very funny. It's kind of all over the place. Like, plot-wise, it really doesn't make a whole fucking lot of sense. But that's really not why you go and see this movie. It's just so charming. And Pascal and Cage are just so fun together. I don't really know. There was nothing I didn't really like about it. Other than the fact that the plot was kind of just like there. Mm-hmm. I'm like, but it's so much fun. How do you not enjoy this?
I think the movie is a whole lot more interesting than it appears on the surface, too, because Nicolas Cage he's playing himself, but he's playing this version of himself that is what everyone perceives Nicolas Cage to be.
Yes.
As this kind of, like, larger-than-life, over-the-top, big personality, type of person who, like, just really loves to work a lot and is very into being, like, an actor, and it doesn't matter what the role is, he'll give it his all. And this is basically, like, you know, why we kind of love Nicolas Cage, and also the fact that, like, he, for a long time, got himself into tremendous debt and had to basically work every shitty direct-to-video movie to dig himself out. And apparently he's out of debt now, which is a good thing. But it's even in those crappy direct-to-video movies he was doing, he was giving it his all. He was there 100%. And he's playing that version that everyone perceives him to be, but not as a caricature, not as a broad stereotype. Instead, he is turning that into a portrait of a man who is hurting. And it becomes very interesting because he is building a genuine character out of himself. This, I have to assume that Nicolas Cage is not actually this version of Nicolas Cage. That the real Nicolas Cage is a lot more kind of, like, you know, nuanced and subtle and, you know, normal than what is presented on screen here. But this version is interesting and works dramatically and is incredibly funny too. And it works well by Cage doing it on his own, but it is taken up to a whole new level in the fact that Pedro Pascal is doing so much of the heavy lifting in this movie, having to play essentially like the straight man in the whole thing for Cage to bounce this performance off of. But he is also doing tremendous work where he elevates to this whole other level. And the two of them bouncing off each other creates something that is kind of magical in the entire film. The bulk of the movie is them together. And every time they are together, it is just riveting. And you can't tear your eyes away. And you're just enjoying every moment of it. It's just delightful from beginning to end.
And I fully agree, and I think you totally nailed it. I think that the performances and, like, what's happening with the characters is way more interesting than anything that's happening in the plot. Mm-hmm. So, for me, and that's the thing, like, I can't... Like, I want to, like, get everybody to watch this, but it's like, ask me what it's about. I'm like, well, you know, it's kind of this silly story, but, like, it's everything else that's happening that's really, really good and that makes you want to watch the movie. And that's really the selling feature. And you nailed it. It's the performances. It's what's happening within the characters. Not so much the plotting, which I think is kind of ridiculous and sort of ham-fisted, but it's still fun within the context. And, I mean, I really like Tiffany Haddish, and I think she's great here, even though her character really doesn't need to be there. That whole CIA side story, sort of stupid and ridiculous, but it moves the story along and it gives the characters more time to play off of each other, so hey, it's all good by me.
But not even so much plot, just tonally. The movie swings back and forth between different tones. Like, we touched about all the different genres it goes through, and it's like it will go from family drama to absurd satire, like flipping a switch and back and forth amongst these like different genres, and it never for a moment feels jarring or out of place or in conflict with itself, and it moves through all of these different tones with such confidence, and it works so perfectly that the whole thing feels like a magic trick. I kind of describe this as like you watch a juggling act that's so good that you walk away from the show going, I think I just saw physics being defied, but I'm not sure. That's what this movie feels like.
Yeah, totally. I you've nailed it. I'm not even going to add anything else because I think that that's exactly where it ends. And that's the thing. It'll totally work. The one thing that I'm not sure about is, I mean, I like Nicolas Cage a lot, so I was kind of already there. I'm not quite sure how well this will play for somebody that's just not a Nicolas Cage fan or just a passing Nick Cage fan. I don't know.
You know, I was thinking about that too, and I think it will play just fine for them, because even if you aren't like a big Nicolas Cage fan, it's like, as long as you don't like go, oh God, Nicolas Cage, I can't stand this guy. If that's the case, then why are you watching this movie? But even if you're not like a huge fan of his work or overly familiar with his films, but you know, you're like, oh, Nick Cage, sometimes he's good. I think the movie is still just entertaining enough on a base level that you're still really going to enjoy it. I've seen a lot of reviews sort of like focusing on it. Well, if you're really into like Face Off, then you might like this movie. And like, I think that's an incredibly unfair assessment of the film. I think even if you have absolutely no affinity for the, if you're not a fan of Nicolas Cage in the sense of like, oh my God, I'll watch everything he does, or, you know, he's amazing in everything. Even if you just casually like him, this is a very enjoyable and very funny movie. And I have a hard time believing that you're not going to love it.
So yeah, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. Recommended.
Yes. The only other thing I just want to say is that I think this is a movie that comes at the exact perfect time, in that if you made this movie 10 years ago, it wouldn't really make sense for where Nicolas Cage was in his career at that time. And if you did it 10 years from now, it would be too late. Somehow this movie like just happens at the exact point in Nicolas Cage's real life career that this movie needs to happen. So it's kind of a minor miracle that this movie exists.
Agreed. Agreed. Another minor miracle of a movie that exists, The Northman. And I'm not even joking, because I'm not 100% sure how Roger Eggers actually managed to get this movie made, and not by A24, which is even more shocking. This was the joke when we saw it. It's like, how is this not an A24 movie? So from the director of The Lighthouse and The Witch comes perhaps his most commercially viable film. I don't even know. I don't know, because there's no way that you watch this movie and you're like, yeah, this thing is going to be like a mainstream hit. I mean, it comes from a guy that made The Lighthouse and The Witch. And yes, it has a pretty impressive cast, but it's still an uber violent movie about a Viking that's seeking revenge. How does that not sound bloody and really, really violent? It's also like 2.5 hours long or something ridiculous. So this stars, for those that don't know, been hiding under a rock, Alexander Skarsgård stars as a guy who sees his father murdered, his mother stolen by his uncle of all people. And he sets out and promises to eke out revenge for his family and spends 2.5 hours essentially looking for revenge. So he, you know, grows up away from everybody, comes back, and decides he's going to finally kill his uncle. And then things get kind of convoluted from there. It's a Viking saga by Roger Eggers. So it looks amazing. It looks amazing. I'm sure it's probably period accurate. I have no idea. Viking things are not really as...
From the amount of research that he put into The Witch, I just imagine that it has to be.
Right? I mean, a couple of things. So he co-wrote this with John. I think you pronounce it John. So he, who also wrote Lamb. He's an Icelandic writer, and he writes a lot of like various things, but he does a lot of history books. So I can only imagine that this is probably fairly accurate in that way. The thing that I think is interesting about this story is, yes, it's a revenge tale, but it's also a lot more than that. It's this story about how family secrets can be really detrimental. It's also a story of like finding yourself. It has a lot of stuff going for it. The thing I thought was most interesting is that in a movie that is so male-centric, like it's very like guy-centric, like it's about a bunch of Vikings, in the end it's actually the women that hold all of the power and the control, which I thought was really interesting. Eggers does this really fascinating thing where in one like not even 10 minute long scene, he basically turns the movie upside down by giving Nicole Kidman's character, she plays Skarsgård's mother, by giving her a storyline that actually empowers her and also twists the entire movie sideways. Like, it's kind of a miracle that that manages to be in there. It's super violent. It's very beautiful. The cinematography is stupendous. Some of the visual effects are, I don't know, I don't want to say questionable, but I don't know. They don't fully work. They just look very, very fake. I walked away from it thinking, I don't really love this movie. And 3 weeks later, because it's been that long since I saw it, I still can't get certain images out of my head. So I think that that's to say that I actually did enjoy it in some subconscious way. It's not for everyone. It features a lot of the tropes that Eggers is known for. So there's lots of bodily functions. There's lots of, there's animal symbolism. There's a lot of violence. There is an epic fight sequence at the end with two naked men fighting with lava in the background. It's kind of epic. And it features a really stupendous score, which is probably my favorite part of the movie, walking out of it. Is it for everyone? No. Is it for fans of Viking movies? Yes. That's about all I can say. Oh, one more thing. Alexander Skarsgård, for as good as he tends to be, is super flat in this movie. He has like zero screen presence. Like no charisma whatsoever. I don't know why. He just kind of is walking through this thing and you're like, do you exude any energy whatsoever? He's just so flat and I can't put my finger onto why. And maybe I need to watch the thing again. I don't know.
I mean, but that's kind of Eggers' style, isn't it? Because I felt like The Witch was very much the same way, where it was like, it's, Eggers seems to rely more on like the intensity of the material and then have the performers be kind of just like there present in the scene to kind of like ground the absurdity of it.
I think that that's right. I think it becomes problematic in a movie like this when you have a cast like this one, because Skarsgård feels like he's basically like the newcomer on the block when he's up against Anya Taylor-Joy, who is actually quite good. Nicole Kidman is super captivating. Ethan Hawke, in a very small role right at the beginning, steals the show. Bjork is in this tiny, like, 2 minute scene and she's like fucking amazing. So the fact that everybody like exudes this energy and he's just kind of flat just doesn't help matters any. I think you're right though. And because he is central to the story, perhaps that's what's happening here. It just feels at odds with everybody else's performance. To me, at least.
I can see that. I have not seen this movie yet, but I will eventually get around to it.
So that's The Northman. It's not for everyone. If you watch the trailer and you're like, oh yeah, that's a movie for me, then you're probably going to enjoy it. But yeah, I have a hard time recommending this one on a wide basis, because it's just, yeah, it's got issues. It's got issues. Let's talk about X, Ty West's new movie.
Yeah. So I semi-eagerly dove into X, which is Ty West finally making another movie. A director that I've been kind of like hot and cold on. Some of his stuff I like, and some of his stuff I'm going to be honest, I really don't like. And this is his, I guess the best way to describe it is a love letter to the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where he's essentially making that as a slasher film set in the 70s in the South. And also, it is about a bunch of characters that are basically going up to a cabin to make a porn film in the 70s. So it's kind of mixing these two kind of like, you know, lurid aesthetics together and tried to draw a parallel to them. And kind of famously or not famously, when Tobe Hooper made the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, he's like, well, we have enough money to either make a porn movie or a horror movie, and decided to make the horror movie. And you can look at the original Texas Chainsaw and say, well, this like, it almost has like a really kind of like, you know, down and dirty porn aesthetic to it. That comes from making a low-budget 16mm film in the 70s. So it's, I can see where the inspiration is for that. And while I did like this movie, it's a very tepid like. And I have been seeing people absolutely lose their shit over this movie. Like, it is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And honestly, I don't see it. It's too shallow and uninteresting to really kind of elevate it to that level. It's a mediocre slasher film at best. And the entire movie felt like... Because the villains in the movie, essentially the killers in the movie, or the killer... killers, we'll go plural. Basically a couple of, like, an elderly couple that owns this farm that they're renting a cabin on. And when I say elderly, I mean cartoonishly elderly. I mean, these are a couple of... I haven't looked up the age of the actors who play it, but I'm assuming people in, like, their 40s or 50s or something like that, that have had ridiculous prosthetics applied to them to make them look like they are the Crypt Keeper. And I thought that maybe it was going to get to the thing, because it's constantly implying, it's like, oh, these old people, they're horny too, and they are looking enviously at, like, these young kids that are making this porn film and have their whole lives in front of them, and all they can see is their lives that are behind them and all the things that they missed and what they'll never have again because they're too old. And it's like, okay, I kind of get that, but I thought it was going to be driving at something a little bit more supernatural, where it's like they've been alive for like 800 years and they've been sucking the life juices of young, horny kids so that they can be young and horny again, you know, sort of thing, which would have been interesting. And that's what felt like it was going towards. But no, it's just old people are creepy and weird, especially when they try to get sexy. And so, murder. It's like, that's all there is really to it. So it's got some interesting gore. The kills are kind of neat. All the characters, I hated. Every single character in this movie, I wanted to die a horrible death. And most of them do. But I enjoyed seeing them die, so I didn't have to hear them anymore. Everything else leading up to that point felt like suffering almost, because everyone was so insufferably awful to spend time with. It's a movie full of horrible people that you don't want to spend time with, and then occasionally they die horrible deaths. So it's my genuine hot take, and this is where everyone's gonna like flip their shit, is that honestly I think this movie is barely better than the recent Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie, which everyone hated. When you look realistically at the movies, they're pretty damn similar. They both had casts of characters where I hated everyone in it. A few good gore moments. And other than that, nice polish. And I think half the reason why people are losing their shit over this movie and calling it a masterpiece is because there's an A24 logo in front of it. I think that's all it takes. It gets like two automatic stars from people just for being an A24 film.
You kind of nailed it. I wasn't going to talk about this because I just didn't care for it at all. For me, it was even worse than the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, because I didn't care for it in any way, shape, or form. And when I saw everybody kind of raving about it, I'm like, this is clearly the Ty West love. Because, I mean, I do like the guy. I mean, I don't know him from anywhere, but like I like his energy and the fact that he keeps making or trying to make these scrappy movies that are interesting. But most of the time, they don't work for me. And I've just kind of given up on the fact that he's ever going to make a movie that I'm truly going to love.
Yeah.
The most exciting part about this for me was seeing Brittany Snow. Honestly, that was what I was most excited about. I'm like, hey, here she is. And oh, God, she's terrible. Oh, well. Next thing.
That was kind of... Yeah, and I know I sound like I'm really down on the movie. And ultimately, I did very tepidly like it. I didn't hate this movie. I'm probably never going to watch it again. It's a very average slasher film, and there's not a lot of meat on this bone.
I mean, I don't hate a lot of stuff. I didn't hate it. I just indifferent to it. I'm like, okay, time I'm never going to get back. Oh, well, next thing. is basically what it came down to. Something else that is kind of falling into that same bracket that I saw was, I saw Gold, which is Anthony Hayes' new movie, which anybody will probably know anything about only because it stars Zac Efron. So Zac Efron plays this this guy that's looking for gold in the desert. I couldn't even tell you the desert where. I think maybe Australia, but I'm not 100% sure. He finds something with his friend. Somebody has to stay behind to guard this giant pile of gold while they go and get equipment to dig it out. And Zac Efron decides he's going to stay. And then shit goes sideways, right? Because, I mean, he's in the desert, in the middle of nowhere. He doesn't have enough water. He doesn't have enough food. There's sandstorms. He starts to see things. Things go sideways. Maybe he's seeing visions. Maybe there's two women. We don't really know. It's kind of just passingly interesting. It's mostly just notable because it's Zac Efron. That's really it. And he's not bad in it. It's just the movie is very, very forgettable. That's it. That's all I got to say about that.
Okay.
Let's talk about...
I haven't even heard of this movie.
Yeah, literally, it came up on my radar because I'm like, oh, Zac Efron. All right, sure. Okay, let's talk about Uncharted, which I tried to get Dan to watch last night, and he's like, I had no idea he had this much hate for Mark Wahlberg. He's like, I don't want to watch a Marky Mark movie. I'm like, since when has this happened? But okay. So apparently this is something I'm going to be watching on my own. But tell me, is it even worth my time?
Okay, so... Let's see, where to start with this movie. So I don't want to kind of approach this thing from the position of someone who, you know, might be a fan of the games. I don't want to be that person. You know, the fan of Uncharted, Uncharted 2, Among Thieves, Uncharted 3, Drake's Deception, Uncharted 4, A Thief's End, and Uncharted the Lost Legacy. I've certainly not played through these games multiple times. And I'm familiar with all the characters and storylines, you know, very intimately, and have a great deal of love and affection for this franchise.
That no sarcasm here whatsoever. Yeah. None.
So, I went into this movie knowing that, A, this is a movie that they've been trying to make for about 15 years. It has gone through about 8 different directors, all of which who have left the project due to creative differences, and has gone through so many different iterations. At one point, with one director, this was going to be a movie where Mark Wahlberg was going to be playing Drake, and Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro were going to be playing his father and uncle, and it was going to be a family of art thieves, and like, this is Uncharted? That's not even the story. It's like, what the hell's happening? So thank God that didn't happen. What we do get is they're very much adapting the games. This is Uncharted the games, with Tom Holland in the lead as Drake and Mark Wahlberg playing Sully. And it's okay. It's inoffensively bland is the best way I can put it. They're pulling from all of the games. The movie opens with a scene from the third game, and then the plot is largely ends up being most of the fourth game, and they're cherry picking scenes and set pieces from all across the games for this movie and kind of putting it together into its own little sandwich. And there are points at which it works. The biggest problem with this movie that I had was the entire relationship that gets made between Drake and Sully, where for whatever reason it ends up feeling, because they're trying to essentially like origin story this stuff in and show this is like, you know, is where Drake first meets Sully and it's his first kind of treasure hunt, which all technically I guess takes place before the games do. It ends up feeling like it's Mark Wahlberg is the protagonist of this film, and Tom Holland is like the bumbling sidekick that eventually graduates into being the protagonist. And it's a relationship that does not work at all. And it's, I think even the movie understands this doesn't work, because as soon as possible, it tries to separate those two characters, as, you know, by distance, so that all of a sudden Drake has to start making decisions on his own. Up until then, he's just kind of doing what people tell him to do. And it's like, this is not what I came. I came to see, like, Drake be hero and go treasure hunt, not be told by other people what he should be doing and trying to figure it out along the way. And it isn't until it had the same problem that the most recent Tomb Raider movie had, where by the time you get to the very end of the movie, you're like, wow, that all felt like set up for the movie I really want to be watching. And that's where this movie ends up too, where it's like 10 minutes before the end of the movie is like Drake's costume is complete and you get the theme song come in and it's like, he's finally arrived. He is now Drake. It's like, oh, I want to watch this movie. Start here. But unfortunately, that's not what they did. And so, like I said, the movie has some moments and set pieces which are pretty good. But it all feels fairly weak sauce. It's the best way I described it is that if you have absolutely no familiarity with the games, it's going to be a perfectly fine, bland adventure movie. And if you are a fan of the games, it's just going to be a frustrating time.
Okay, so I might be okay with it since I've never played the game.
Yeah. It's not great. I'd love to see them make a great, genuine stab at this. Not that this was a genuine stab at this franchise, but make something that's like a little bit more kind of concentrated. There's a better version of this movie, and I just wish they made it. And I can sort of see the bones there, and it's just like they didn't get there. And one of the things that started to feel like a problem that ended up not being a problem for me was that Tom Holland's not a very big guy. He's not physically imposing in any way. And you don't get the sense that he can hold his own in, like, a fist fight at all with any, like, sizable dude. Which is a departure for the games, because Drake is just, like, an average guy who's got some body strength, and he can hold his own in a bar fight. And Tom Holland, not so much so. And instead, what they do is they end up bringing a lot of Tom Holland's ability to do, like, parkour and shit like that into it. And it actually kind of works. I think he wields it in an interesting way. And I think he's also just able to bring forth that kind of like, oh, shucks, what the hell have I gotten myself into? Oh, boy, this attitude that Drake kind of has in the games. He can do that, I think, fairly well. So I think he captures the personality well. Anyway, I would kind of love to see him in a much better version of this movie.
Do you think they'll make a sequel where he actually, like, has the reins?
I don't know, because, well, short answer, yes. Not knowing how well this movie did or did not do, I have no idea if it was, like, a giant bomb or not. I'm just looking up the numbers real quick. Almost 400 million worldwide. That's not great. I'm assuming they wanted like around 800 million off this movie, but it's also like they didn't lose money on it. And I think also that part of the reason why Tom Holland is leading this movie is Sony wants to be very much in the Tom Holland business. If they can have a franchise to attach Tom Holland to, then that makes it easier for them to keep him around for Spider-Man.
Makes so much sense.
I think they're just trying to, like, as much as possible do Tom Holland stuff. And if an Uncharted franchise is the way to keep him in Spider-Man, I think they'll keep making Uncharted movies.
It's nice to have that kind of cachet.
I know. He might be the last legitimate movie star that we've got.
Probably, at least of the new breed, yes, for yeah. Sure. Him and Zendaya, let's do it. Mm-hmm. I watched Trust No One, The Hunt for the Crypto King, and I literally watched this because I'm a big fan of the podcast. The CBC did a 7 or 8 episode podcast last year called A Death in Cryptoland, which I also went into completely blind. Like, I know what crypto is, but that's really all I knew. Mm. So this is on Netflix. It's a doc about Quadriga's CX, I guess, founder, Jerry Cotton, who died mysteriously in India a couple of years ago. And I mean, you have to get into like the whole dynamics of how crypto works. But basically, there's a stash of money that apparently no one has access to because no one has the key to unlock this money.
Well, the key kind of disappeared with him. So he's got this bank account that has all of, because it was a holdings company, or, you know, they would trade the crypto. You want to buy crypto, you go through Quadriga. You want to sell your crypto, you go through Quadriga. And all of this money that they were sitting on in Bitcoin that they had in their holdings, the key to this account disappeared with him. So there's all this money sitting in a locked account that no one can get into.
Exactly. And I mean, you don't have to know a whole lot about crypto. They explain everything that you need to know in order to make this interesting. There's just so many bits and pieces that make this story so fascinating. And honestly, I just thought that the people they interviewed are fascinating in their own right, because they talked to a couple of people that kind of got sort of mixed up in this unbeknownst to them. Like, they were basically just, you know, trying to move money, crypto, like in an illegal way, and the company was totally above board. It's just all of a sudden they've lost their money because this guy is dead. And it's fascinating. I mean, it'll have varying degrees. Like, if you're vaguely interested in crypto, this might be something that you might be interested in. If you're at all interested in, like, if you've listened to the podcast or you want to know a little bit more about Jerry, this is definitely the documentary for you. It treads a lot of the same ground. I don't think it has like any breaking, it doesn't unveil anything new. What I thought was particularly interesting is that one of the things that keeps coming up when they talk about Jerry Cotton and is his wife, and the fact that nobody understands how she didn't have the key, and she keeps saying she doesn't have the key. So now there's this mystery about, you know, how much truth is there to this? There really is an ongoing mystery. So it's just a sort of a fascinating little niche watch, one that I really, really enjoyed, mostly because the story is super fascinating. And I love the fact that it has a local angle, because nothing happens in Vancouver ever, apparently, other than, you know, guys dying with billions of dollars left in crypto that nobody can get access to. So, hey, bonus.
Yeah, I haven't seen this doc yet. It's been on my watch list, but I did watch a different documentary about a year ago that CBC put out. It's like an hour-long doc that they did that was on the same story. So I'm kind of familiar with the details of the story, but it's very much kind of like the
the Cliff Notes?
No, the Dropout.
Company. Yeah.
The Elizabeth Holmes story. It's kind of one of those things where it's like, no matter how much I already know about the story, I kind of like, oh, there's another documentary about that. I kind of want to consume it too, because I find the story so interesting and fascinating. There's like just enough kind of like lurid conspiracy bits surrounding the story of like potentially like malicious intent that I find it fascinating. But I think the bigger thing that I take away from this whole story is it is a tremendous illustration of the just kind of how untenable in a lot of ways crypto is, or insecure in the fact that, like, if you can have one person just suddenly like die in a company, and then all of that company's holdings just kind of disappear into the ether because of that, that's kind of fucked up. That's not really a secure replacement for money, among all the other reasons why crypto is bad. Not a fan.
No, I mean, for me, I don't know enough about crypto one way or I know enough to get myself in trouble is what I joke, because, I mean, at some point I did try to buy crypto. I think I bought a cent's worth. I couldn't figure out the crypto wallet thing. This was like in the late 90s before it was an easy thing to do. So now I'm to the point where I know it's this thing that's out there. I just don't really care about it. Knowing that, I mean, I think that we've moved beyond the point of, you know, one guy holding the keys to the empire. I mean, I think there are companies out there that are like actual companies with you know, actual shareholders and people that are keeping tabs on what's happening. This just happened to be, like, it's not that it happened even that long ago.
Alarmingly, but I think, a lot less than you might think.
Well, this is the other thing, right? So, I mean, I think there needs to be, like, a bigger story on the whole crypto thing. But, like you say, this is just, like, lurid enough and interesting enough. And really what got me was the whole Vancouver connection that I kind of went, okay, well, let's see what this is about. So, I mean, yeah. The documentary is, it's not, like, groundbreaking or, like, particularly, like, wow. But it's just another layer to this story.
I think it's the story itself that is quite interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, for so sure.
Even a mediocre documentary on it, which, you know, arguably the CBC doc I watched was fairly mediocre, I think it's still an interesting story.
Yeah, and then that doc is actually tied into the podcast. The podcast is quite good. The podcast is quite good. I'll link to it in the show notes if anybody's interested to listen to that. Talk to me about Alice. I don't even know. I was going to look this up and then I didn't have time.
Yeah, I just randomly came across this movie. So the best way I can describe Alice is imagine the twist that's at the end of The Village. I'm going to spoil The Village for everyone. M. Night Shyamalan's The Village from, like, God, 15 years ago at this point, however long ago it was. So plug your ears if you don't want the ending of this spoiled. But the Amish community that they live in is basically just, like, it's out in a forest somewhere, and it's like, they're not out in the middle, you know. It's
controlled.
Yeah. As soon as she steps outside the gate, she's like, oh, I was in, like, a theme park, and I didn't know it, and there's a whole world out here sort of thing. And that's the twist of The Village. So Alice is basically, the beginning of the movie is basically a southern slave plantation, and Alice is a slave with a bunch of other people on the southern plantation, and she thinks it's, like, you know, 1930 or whenever it is. And after a bunch of things happen, we spend a whole bunch of time on the plantation with the plantation owner, played by Johnny Lee Miller. She escapes and discovers it is not the 1930s. It is actually like 1974. And she suddenly ends up in a world that she doesn't know existed, and basically lands smack dab in a world that is embracing civil rights, and it morphs into essentially a blaxploitation revenge thriller at that point, but plays it more like a drama. And this all sounds very interesting and intriguing because I haven't seen this movie before. The main character, Alice, is played by... blanking for a moment. What is her name? Let me look it up real quick. Is played by Kiki Palmer. And she ends up getting picked up on the outside world by Common. And he basically, like, shows her the ropes of, like, this is the world that's going on. And this is a debut film from Christian Van Linden. And ultimately, I think the movie itself doesn't work. We spend way too much time in the beginning on the plantation. We kind of get it. Not enough time in the outside world. And it doesn't quite go far enough. And it's, like, it's also potentially, I don't want to say disrespectful, but it's exploitative in a way that doesn't necessarily feel all that comfortable. It's a very interesting idea, but at the end of the day, you're like, was this movie a good idea? Maybe not. I don't know. It maybe has some interesting things to say. And if it had a few more interesting things to say and was maybe a little bit more even-handed, then it could have been amazing, but instead it's just kind of there. And I didn't dislike it, but I think it's also pretty hard to recommend too.
Oh,
really interesting premise though.
I was kind of like scrunching my head because I was like, haven't we seen this movie? And there was another movie where they were kidnapping women and taking them to like the reenactment thing. Do you remember
this? Well, there was that movie Antebellum.
That's the one I'm thinking about, yeah. Yeah,
from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's why I was scratching my head. I'm like, wait, haven't we seen this? But then you said 1970s. I'm like, no, I clearly remember cell phones.
Yeah, no, this is a different movie. But it like, just the base idea of, like, okay, we're going to do slave plantation in the South. But surprise, it's the 1970s, and now we're moving into a blaxploitation genre. There's a hook there that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the movie just didn't pay off enough to be worth that hook.
Oh, that's too bad. I watched Tony Hawk Until the Wheels Fall Off, which is the new Tony Hawk documentary on HBO. There have been a lot of Tony Hawk documentaries, so it's clear you need to say this is the new one. What I think is really interesting about this one, it's probably the most encompassing Tony Hawk documentary that I've ever seen, because it was made with Tony Hawk. It's directed by Sam Jones, who's made a number of these sort of, you know, X Games documentaries. Hawk was involved from the beginning. There's a lot of like home footage and early footage of him. What I think is particularly interesting about Tony Hawk is the fact that a documentary about Tony Hawk is kind of like a documentary about modern skateboarding as we know it, and basically the rise, fall, and re-rise of it. And I think to me that's probably the most interesting part. He just happens to be the central figure that carries us through the various stages of skateboard culture and how it's sort of become part of the mainstream. He was there at the beginning of it, he was there when it went downhill, and he was there when it rose from the ashes like a phoenix. It's really interesting. It's not for everybody. I don't think it is actually a pretty good sort of intro if you're just like vaguely curious about skate culture, because I think it does sort of touch on all like sort of the key elements. And Tony Hawk is a really fascinating guy. Like, he's now in his like late 40s, maybe 50. I don't even know how old he is, but he's certainly like kind of pushing on for this type of sport that is this physical. And he still puts himself out there every day. Like, you know, they talk to him and he's like, I'm still skating like 4 or 5 hours a day. Like, this is his life. And it's amazing to see that level of commitment for somebody on anything. So it's really fascinating. I mean, I've always been fascinated by skate culture. I've never skateboarded in my life. I tried it once and almost broke my head. So that was kind of the end of it for me. But it's always been this thing that I was kind of fascinated with. And the fact that it's sort of entered the mainstream has always been something that I was kind of like really curious about. So it's a really interesting documentary. It's not reinventing the wheel. It's probably not even the best like documentary about skate culture, but as an intro to like a really fascinating figure and an interesting sort of sport, because I think you could call it that, I think it's really well done, and I think you could do much, much worse. So that's my recommendation of Tony Hawk, Until the Wheels Fall Off. Because I do recommend it. I think it's worth your time. Hellbender. Is this a Shudder release?
This is a Shudder release.
Talk to me, because I've seen this. I've been
hearing people talk about Hellbender, so mm-hmm. I decided to give it a watch. Which is, I guess, more or less he called a witch movie. This is an extremely low-budget movie. In all the best and worst ways. Here's a movie that halfway through, I don't want to be mean and say I was saying, like, asking myself why I was watching it. At the same time, I was like, I don't know about this movie. It, like, feels very much from, like, a early 70s movie that would be shot on 16mm with no money, with, you know, local stage talent that doesn't know how to act and doesn't really even want to be in horror movies, and it sort of has that feel to it, which is its own charm. And I stuck with the movie, and it ultimately got a lot more interesting And I think that the charm kind of caught up with the film to the point where when I got to the end, I was kind of like rooting for the film in a weird way. Like when you go to like a film festival and you see someone whose ambitions are like way too big for what they're actually able to achieve. At the same time, I don't think this film was like, I don't think it's necessarily that their eyes were too big for their stomach, in the sense that the film was beyond their grasp, because it essentially, it's a two-hander of a movie between a young coming-of-age girl living in the woods with her mother. They're both witches, or as they describe it, hellbenders, which is like a very specific type of witch that basically they have the ability to tap into essentially like dark magic. And it basically becomes about this young girl both craving to, you know, grow beyond the childhood that her mother has kind of like kept her locked into for her own safety, and also figuring out who she is and what she wants in life. And it ultimately does get to interesting places. And then you get to the end of the movie and go, wow, this really was just made by five people. Is the same names over and over again. And I looked it up too, and it's quite interesting because the daughter is played by Zelda Adams and the mother by Toby Poser, who is actually Zelda Adams' mother in real life, as also co-directed and co-written by John Adams, who has a role in the movie, who is her father. So it is basically just a family that made this low-budget horror movie together, and they're, with the exception of like a few other credits for like visual effects and whatnot, they're the only names on this film.
Wow.
You could practically call it a home movie. And it's not the first time they've done this either. They also made Hellbenders like a short twice. They made like two Hellbender shorts, and then they made this feature. So they've been kind of like made this like little like home movie factory of low budget, you know, kind of like schlocky horror and thriller films, which is kind of neat. And it's an interesting movie. I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say I loved it, but I guess I'm glad I watched it, and I thought it was neat and worth a watch. If you're into, you know, less than polished horror filmmaking, I think there's something here. And I don't know. I'm curious to see what else they make.
That's interesting. I have this bad thing. Like, I only log into Shudder once in a blue moon, and then when I do, I'm there for like 2 weeks just watching a bunch of stuff. So this might be my log into Shudder and watch movies for 2 weeks. This might be my phase.
That's the thing that Shudder's really good for. It's like you subscribe to it for a year, but you only like watch it for like 2 months of the year. And you want to watch something, it's nice to have.
Exactly. And it's really not that expensive. It's like $50 or something for the year. Yeah. I'm like, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. It's kind of like my subscription to Arrow Video as well.
There you go.
Whereas, like, I might watch something every 3 months, but at the same time, it's also not that expensive, and it's nice having it there.
Yeah, it's good to support, right?
Yeah.
I was actually actively waiting for this to come out, because I love the trailer so much. So I watched Metal Lords, which is also on Netflix. So this is Peter Sollett's new movie. He did Raising Victor Vargas and Freeheld. And it's written by D.B. Weiss. So half of the Game of Thrones team, and the other half, David Benioff, is actually one of the executive producers. So the basic story here is there's this kid in high school. He loves heavy metal, has always loved heavy metal. He's managed to get his best friend to kind of like metal, but he's not really into it as of yet. But they're trying to get this band together. And then they really have to get this band together because they're going to play the Battle of the Bands. And so there was a Battle of the Bands years before where the metal band won, changed everybody's idea about metal, and then the band disappeared in mysterious ways. Like, nobody really knows what happened. It's all very high school, like, high dramatics. this movie shouldn't work. I fully admit it. It's way too charming for its own good, but fuck, I love this movie, like, so much. Tom Morello is the executive producer of music, so you know the music is awesome, and it is if you're a metal fan. It's just fun. Like, it's basically like a bromance about these two high school boys that, you know, end up eventually finding friendship in music, and like, it's them against the world, and then there's a girl involved, and thing, like, their little universe expands a little bit further. It's also this drama about this kid that wants something so bad that he can almost taste it, and he's trying to, like, navigate this world that doesn't believe in him, even though he believes in himself, which is something that you don't always see. It's super charming. I think it's going to have, like, limited appeal because of the music. Not everybody is into metal. It just is what it is. But the story itself is super, super charming. I like this movie a lot. Like, a lot. It might be one of my favorites of the year so far. So,
really?
Yeah, it just hit all the right charm buttons. So it's one that I really, really enjoyed. And it surprised even me how much I like this movie.
But high praise.
It's pretty fun. It's pretty fun. And before we move to TV, I want to talk about one more movie. Because I watched the bigasm that is Ambulance.
I saw this too, so we can talk about it.
Oh, God. Okay, so I'm sorry. I legitimately did a double take when I'm like, did they fucking just quote a Michael Bay movie in a fucking Michael Bay movie? Like, how inside the game is this? It's also 2 hours long, over 2 hours long, and it's written by like 4 people. How do you need 4 people to write this thing? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh my God. And this is coming from somebody that actually generally enjoys Michael Bay movies, with the exceptions of the Transformers movies, which I have zero patience for. Mm-hmm. The rest of his stuff, I actually generally tend to enjoy, just because they are what they are. It's like watching a Roland Emmerich movie. You know what you're getting when you watch a Michael Bay movie.
Well, the Transformers movies have been almost exclusively his career for the last 15 years.
Well, this is the thing. I didn't like any of them. Like, they were just kind of there. I mean, we went because Dan wanted to watch them. Maybe this is where his Mark Wahlberg hate comes from. I have no idea. It's fine for the first hour. I say fine because it's not even that interesting, but it's kind of fine for the first hour. And then it just becomes fucking annoying as shit. And then I was just like, when is this thing going to end? In the end, I did watch the whole thing, and then I kind of felt embarrassed that I did. And then I was like, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal and Yahya Abdul-Mateen can do so much better than this. The whole thing is just a big fucking mess.
Yeah, much like you, and I feel like you need to preface talking about this movie with what your relationship to Michael Bay is, because I think that's going to color so much about how you feel about this movie.
I like Michael Bay's movies,
generally. Similar to you, I maybe like him a little less. I think The Rock is a brilliant action thriller, and it's a legitimately great movie. I think Armageddon is goofy and dumb, and I'll probably never watch it again. I'm not a huge fan of Pain and Gain, although I understand why people do like that movie. So I give that one a bit of a pass. I think Bad Boys 2 is an incredibly pretty movie that you need to turn the sound off to enjoy.
I forgot. I legitimately forgot about Bad Boys 2.
Yeah. And I absolutely despise the Transformers movies. I have absolutely no affinity to those things whatsoever. If you love those movies, I'm sorry, but I'm just not a fan. I've never had any connection to Transformers, and I find his movies fairly incomprehensible and impossible to enjoy. And the other thing is, I legitimately hated Six Underground. I thought that was an unwatchable mess of a movie. I couldn't even make it all the way through.
I honestly don't think I've seen it. Like, at this point, I can't remember actually watching it.
That was the one he did for Netflix about 2 years ago.
Yeah, so if I did watch it, I've forgotten about it. This is how much I enjoyed it.
And that movie is very much the most Michael Bay movie I've ever seen. Like just ramped up to 11, and nothing makes a lick of sense. This movie is at least more comprehensible. And I've heard a lot of people saying that, like, this is Michael Bay's best movie since The Rock, which maybe it is, but that's a low bar to clear, I think. I've also heard other people describe it as, like, Michael Bay's Michael Mann movie.
And no, okay, yeah, I'm sorry. No. You cannot put the two Michaels in the same sentence together and get away with it. That's just fucking sacrilege at this point.
I think a much closer analog in terms of, like, style and quality.
I think I know where you're
Tony
going.
Scott's,
Don't say it. Don't say it.
Oh, the fucking train movie he did.
No.
Unstoppable.
Tony, you can't. No, like. You can't unstoppable. Put. No, you can't put Tony Scott and Michael Bay in the same sentence.
I did, and you can't stop me.
Oh, if I could reach through the screen right now, I would. Tony Scott. I think
Tony Scott is a much better filmmaker.
Thank you.
Unstoppable is very low quality tier Tony Scott.
Still far superior than I think anything Michael Bay has ever made, and I actually like Michael Bay movies too. So
maybe. I think this movie has some interesting stuff in it, and I think you're right. The first half of it is pretty fun. I like that Michael Bay has finally, in the year 2022, gotten to a point where gay people aren't a punchline. It's like, thank you for catching up, Michael.
That is another
glad
low.
To have you here.
Another low bar to clear.
We're clearing all the bars that you would have to dig to not clear.
And the fact that the women actually have lines that and they're just not eye candy. Another low bar to clear.
Female character in this movie,
right?
Like, we're breaking all sorts of new ground in Michael Bay territory, which is great, awesome. I love that, and I'd much rather see him do this than see him do Transformers movies. Don't get me wrong. Jake Gyllenhaal is obviously having a lot of fun in this movie. Michael Bay is still very much in this territory of, like, or at least the script is, but it fits with every movie he's ever made, where even though he's trying to make, like, a serious and saccharine crime thriller, it still very much lives in this world where the getaway driver pulls up to the bank talking with his wife on the phone and said, "Well, I'm glad you're having a bath. I hope you drown in it." That's the movie that this is, where people say ridiculous shit that make no sense at all just because no one's talking and people need to say something because we might get bored for a second. You know, the banter that happens between the cops was just insufferably awful. It's like, are you gonna eat those Cheetos? Are you just gonna get Cheeto dust everywhere? It's like,
and like I say, they had like at least three writers.
I know.
On credit. That's the even sadder part.
And this is all very much like Michael Bay kind of stuff. And there's the other thing is, like, he did a whole bunch of, like, really kind of technically impressive drone shots that are mixed in with the action, where, like, drones are literally, like, flying at ground level through the action and whatnot. But a lot of these shots are also entirely incomprehensible as to why they're even there, because it suggests that it's from the point of view of something, but of what? I don't know what it would be as a point of view of. And it kind of gets, this movie is very much like the Achilles heel of everything that, like, has always been wrong with Michael Bay, in that he has this incessant need to constantly be moving the camera because motion equals intensity. And the only thing that matters is, does this individual moment look cool? With absolutely zero regard for why he's moving the camera, what this means to the story, or how this connects to the next thing that comes. And this is why you suddenly get, like, a car will be driving from left to right in one shot and cut to a shot of the car driving from right to left in the next shot. And there's absolutely no cohesiveness into it. And people go, that's just Bayhem, baby. You either love Bayhem or you don't. And it's like, no, that's just bad filmmaking. You know, it's like, Michael Bay is able to capture a great amount of intensity when the scenes call for it, and when he shines, he's really good. And I just wish that he thought about why he was doing what he was doing a little bit more, except he doesn't seem to understand why he's doing, just that he needs to keep doing it. And that's the really frustrating part. The other thing is that the script is garbage.
Yeah.
It's an absolute nonsense script that burns out everything it has to say in the first half of the movie and then just keeps going. And it even gets to a point where it feels like the movie is bored of itself and it starts clowning on itself and starts becoming like a satire of itself in certain points.
Yeah, it's just, where it's gets
late. What are you doing? You don't, even the movie doesn't want to be here anymore. And yeah. Then it will switch out of that and go into like self-serious and saccharine and want you to start crying at something that's emotionally resonant. It's like the tone is like, we talked about like the unbearable weight of massive talent and just how that movie juggled tone so expertly between all of the different genres that it was moving through like air. And then this movie, which just totally crashes into itself on a constant basis.
It's like so clunky. Like two
trains getting derailed.
Yeah, it's so clunky. I wish I could say, hey, this is a good Michael Bay movie. It's not. I say totally skip it. It's not worth your 2 hours and 15 minutes. I wish I could take at least half of that time back.
Yeah, I got halfway through the movie and I didn't care anymore. And then I kept watching and I was never rewarded for my continued watching of it.
I'm exactly in the same boat. Exactly in the same boat. Yeah. So I say skip it. It's just not worth your time.
So I don't know. If this is Michael Bay's back, baby, I'm just like, do better, Michael.
I agree. And he can do better. We've seen better. Let's just hope he can deliver better.
Amazing movie.
Agreed. We can agree on that. Let's just ask that Criterion reissue that release that is like impossible to find now, even used. I still
have the DVD for The Rock.
I think I have.
Criterion release.
Oh, see, and that's the only release that they ever did. They never have released it since. So no, I missed out on that.
They've lost a license after that. There was a brief period where Criterion was like, hey, what if our movies actually made money? And they started, like, licensing stuff like The Rock and Armageddon, which, let's be honest, when you look at the breadth of the Criterion collection, Michael Bay's movies do not belong in there.
No, they actually did. I didn't realize they did a Criterion of Armageddon. I knew about the Criterion of The Rock, because that's one I've actually actively looked for in my life and have never managed to find.
Well, and the Armageddon one is legendary, and you can find clips of it on YouTube simply for the commentary that was recorded for, and it was recorded by Criterion. And it's the one where Ben Affleck starts telling the story where it's like, hey, what, like, why are we sending drillers into space? Wouldn't it make more sense to teach astronauts how to drill? And he's like, Michael just said to me, shut the fuck up, Ben, just do the scene. I was like, okay,
that's hilarious. Let's talk about something that hopefully is better. Moon Knight. We're gonna get into some TV. Let's talk about Moon Knight.
Yeah, so we're like 4 episodes into the 6-episode little mini series run that is Moon Knight. A character which I knew nothing about going into the show. I'd read none of the comics. Every time I ask someone to tell me what's the deal with Moon Knight, give me like the primer for what I need to know about this character, people say, well, he's kind of like Marvel's Batman. And I'm like, it sure doesn't seem like Marvel's Batman at all. It's like, I still don't feel like anyone's given me a good explanation of what Moon Knight is. But I feel like the show is kind of like catching me up on the character. And I'm kind of oscillating between whether or not I like this show. It's very weird. It borders between interesting and ludicrously goofy. Yes. And I kind of want to hold out until I see the final 2 episodes to see like whether or not I end up loving it or whether it's just going to remain this weird artifact. I kind of love that they're embracing the weirdness of it. This character is basically been like inhabited by an Egyptian god and forced to do his bidding, which means basically fighting off the other Egyptian gods, essentially. And it's also like a petty god that it's moody. And I think the most interesting thing about this show that I'm really digging is, of course, the main character, Stephen Grant / Mark Spector, is being played by Oscar Isaac. And he is a character that essentially suffers from dissociative identity disorder. And it's two people, but same body. Oscar Isaac playing both roles. And he will communicate with himself basically through reflections. And any reflective surface, he will see whichever version of him is asleep, and they'll have conversations back and forth. And you have one where he's putting on this kind of like really sort of frail British affectation accent as Stephen Grant. And then Mark Spector is just like, is very kind of like a American dude bro. And Oscar Isaac is playing both sides of this conversation. And he's doing a fantastic job at like playing both sides of this role and making you believe that he's two completely different characters. Which, this so far is the most interesting, compelling part of the entire series to me. It's just what Oscar Isaac is doing and the performance that he's giving.
That's pretty much the only appeal this show has for me at this point. I mean, I jokingly said to Dan, Marvel has gotten to the point now where they've already dug through the A, B, and C cast of superheroes, and now they're into the D, E, F, G, H, and Z. Mm. So we like, and that's totally fine, because I mean, it's fresh, it's new. I like the fact that they're kind of digging into material that seems so, like you say, ludicrous and kind of ridiculous. I mean, like fucking Egyptian gods and dual personalities and whatever else. To me, like you, the most interesting part about the whole thing is Oscar Isaac, who's freaking amazing playing two completely different people, like completely different personalities. They even walk differently. They move differently. The physicality of the role is really interesting. Him and Ethan Hawke, who I just have like a lifelong crush on, are the two, like, for me, the things that keep me coming back week after week to watch the show, because I could really care less about the rest of it. Even though I always had like a soft spot for Egyptology, I just don't really care about the show enough. Like, it's just kind of there.
It's vaguely interesting. Yeah. It's got some like adventure appeal to it. I'm not, like, in love or infatuated with everything that's happening story-wise, but it's definitely his performance that is really selling the film for me, or Agreed. The show for me, and keeping me with it. It's going to be really interesting to see, like, I imagine at some point they're going to, like, integrate. Moon Knight's going to show up in, like, someone else's movie or something like that. And, like, that's going to be interesting and weird. I kind of want to see what that is. I don't know, but I think you're totally right about the about Marvel is now, like, you know, they're bringing out the D-list characters sort of thing. Stuff that most people, unless you're like a hardcore dyed-in-the-wool comic nerd, you have never heard of these characters. I sort of reached that point with the teaser that was at the end of the Eternals, where you had Kit Harington like pulls out, you know, this sword, and it's like it built like this big moment of like, oh my god, that's who it is. And I'm like, I need to go to the internet because I have no idea what the fuck I'm looking at right now. And like, and then after I looked up, oh, he's the Black Knight. Who is that? I have never heard of this character. And I'm a pretty nerdy person who's read a lot of comics in their time, and I've never fucking heard of this character in my life. So that's kind of where we're at with the movies and shows now, where we're in the realm of the stuff that I have never even heard of.
And honestly, I think that that's fine, because then you have... I think at that point you can play more in the margins, and this kind of feels like it's really playing in the margins. And I love the fact that a lot of it feels, I mean, I don't know how authentic it is, but it does feel like it has, like, it's being a little bit culturally sensitive. The music is really like Eastern Europe, like it has like that whole Eastern feel. Mm-hmm. You kind of get the sense that a lot of the creative team has that sort of background. So I do appreciate that, and it does, I think, come through in the like the little aesthetic things that show up. It's just the story to me just kind of feels meddling. The performances are what's keeping me interested. So
yeah, they the whole series is it's directed by I believe Moorhead and Benson are involved pretty heavily in the show. Who of course did The Endless, mm-hmm. and what was the one they did just a couple years ago with Anthony Mackie?
Oh, I'm not going to remember.
Synchronic
was yes. the title of it, I believe. Yes, that's the one.
And so they've directed, like, I think a bulk of the Moon Knight episodes, but also involved is, what's his name here? Doug Mensch is involved with it. And so they've definitely brought in some people, like you say, to make sure that it's not, like, culturally insensitive, to make sure that we're actually, like, if we're gonna go do Egypt stuff, let's, you know, do respectful Egypt stuff instead of, like, a bunch of people have no idea, or just drawing from other movies they've seen to sort of, like, depict this world. Yeah, and I'm digging the music for it, too.
That's my favorite part of the aesthetic. The music has been, like, awesome. I've been, like, find this, keep this in the list for me because I'm gonna need to listen to it later. So yeah. I do have sort of a running playlist because I am really enjoying the music.
So I'm curious to see where the last few episodes go, if it's gonna take this entire show into, like, you know, the realm of, like, okay, I see what we were driving to, that's really cool, or if I'm just gonna be like, eh, that was fine.
Yeah,
which we'll I'm see. Guessing it's gonna be more the latter, but I'm hoping for more of the former.
I'm with you 100%. Quickly, I want to mention the thing about Pam, which is the Renee Zellweger, thriller, I guess you would call it, that was on cable TV or primetime TV. I don't even know what you call TV anymore. It was on TV, regular television, people. It was on TV, regular TV. So it's based on the real-life murder of Betsy Faria that happened in 2011. And Renee Zellweger plays Pam Hupp, who was the woman that ultimately was responsible for the murder, and she did it because of money. The whole thing is just fucking ridiculous and crazy. Like, the kind of story that's like, you couldn't make this shit up, so clearly it must be real. And I guess Zellweger takes on the role. She looks quite different. I'm assuming she's in a fat suit, wearing very heavy prosthetics. Her performance is pretty good. Really, the character is just kind of crazy. And the story is just bizarre enough that it's like, Dan and I watched it week after week going, is this thing for real? Like, this is insanity. And it just gets crazier with every episode. It's good. We really enjoyed it. Josh Duhamel is really good in it, and so is Judy Greer, who just kind of randomly shows up and, like, in a couple of episodes, and she kind of kills it and then disappears and doesn't show up until the final episode again. It's just kind of fun. It really is. The story is just insane, but it was entertaining, and clearly she's going for an Emmy. She may get one. I have no clue at this point. I just know it was entertaining.
Well, it's just that unwritten rule. Everything is made better by adding Judy Greer.
This is true. I will go with it. Totally game for it. So that was my, watch the thing about Pam. It's actually pretty good. Let's talk about Severance, which I started. Dan and I watched the first two episodes of this, and we couldn't watch any more in the same night because it was just a little bit too intense, I think would be the word. Mm-hmm. So this is not the kind of thing that we will be binging. So tell me, does it get weirder?
It gets so much weirder.
I find that so impossible because the first episodes are already so fucking weird.
I mean, the first episodes kind of set a good baseline. And I think it's only like the last two episodes that things like really spiral into like a whole new level of weird. But it's constantly slowly ramping. So this movie, it's an Apple TV Plus movie, or show, rather, created by Dan Erickson, who he originally created this as a play, and mm-hmm. then, like, reworked it into a series and essentially sold it to Ben Stiller's company. And Ben Stiller produced and directed the bulk of this show. And it is a very The premise itself is just fascinating. And it is the idea that it is this corporation that has people working in a corporate archives department that is so kind of like high-level security that it has people undergo what it calls the severance procedure, which is this new procedure where people basically get a chip implanted in their head and it splits off their memories. So when they go down the elevator to work, they switch over and they forget everything about their outside life, and all there is their work. And then they leave at the end of the day, and as they take the elevator up, it switches over and they forget everything about their work, and there's just their outside life. And there's almost something that's vaguely appealing about that idea. Like, wouldn't you kind of love it if you could just switch off when you go to your shitty day job, and then you kind of like step back when you leave the job, and so the only thing you really have to endure is your time not at your job? That sounds kind of nice, doesn't it, in a certain way? But of course, like, the reality of that is like much, much darker. And it plays with this premise in so many interesting ways. It's like, because the people who exist in their job like this have absolutely no like frame of reference for the outside world or even knowledge or memory of like who they are out there, they invent an entire kind of like society and theories about life that it's just like based on their very limited worldview inside that job, to the point where the creator of the company gets elevated into a deity like kind of position for people and is seen as God. And it gets very bizarre, very surreal. It's got Adam Scott in the lead role, who's really good. John Turturro. A few other actors in supporting roles, which everyone's very great. It's a deeply weird movie, or deeply weird show, deeply upsetting show. But the hook is so good. I was so sucked into this show. I was like almost begrudging. It's like, okay, people won't stop talking about this. Am I going to finally dive into this show? Fine, I'll give in to you, Severance. I'll give you an episode or two and see what happens. Before you know it, I'd burn through the entire show just in time for the finale. And I'm not going to spoil anything, but the finale is probably one of the tensest pieces of media that I have ever watched. The only thing I can think of to compare it to is like the final act of Uncut Gems.
Where Holy it's shit. Just like
during the entire episode, it's like the show just like stretched all the nerves out of my body and was playing them like a harpsichord. It was so goddamn intense and it is so good. And thankfully, the show is, of course, getting a second season, so we're going to see more of this. But I cannot recommend this show highly enough. I think this is probably the best show that I will see this year. I think everyone should watch this thing.
Yeah, I really liked the first two episodes, but again, like I say, I just felt drained after watching it. Like, I found it a bit too intense for me. Like, there's certain things that sometimes hit in that way that it doesn't feel like it's anything like particularly heavy, but you walk away from it and you're like, fuck, that was really emotionally draining. And that's kind of how I felt after watching episode two. I'm like, I can't watch any more of this tonight. And we just haven't had time to go back to it, but I definitely will, because it's on the cards to finish.
Yeah.
And I just thought that, you know, you mentioned how the sort of the mechanics of the show, but you forgetting when you get into the basement. And I think it's fascinating how they worked that into Adam Scott's character. There is a reason why he wants that particular job, and so I want to know more about that. So I'm really curious to see more of the series, because I really enjoyed it. I just found it really emotionally, just it just took a lot out of me. I watched it.
Yeah, the show is a lot. It's probably best, like, I think, yeah, I watched at max, like, 2 episodes per night, but I did, like, watch the show, like, pretty quickly, because I became low-key obsessed with it. It's the thing that, like, there's surreal elements to it where you can sort of see the logic behind the entire premise of the show. It's like, okay, super secret corporate division, they're very, I could see a corporation stooping to this level. And then you get into what their job actually is and what they do. Their job makes no fucking sense either. And they don't understand what it is they're even looking at. They just look at, like, all of these numbers on a screen, and they have to intuitively decide what the scary numbers are and eliminate them from the pattern of numbers. Like, even if you didn't do this procedure on them, there's nothing that they could talk about because it doesn't make any damn sense either. But it's, and it ends up becoming this situation where it's like this kind of like battle between it. Basically, you can cut this part out of people and segregate it off, but the very nature of human beings will constantly demand to know what the truth is. And so they will seek out to subvert that control, even when they wanted that to control to begin with.
And can I just
it's very interesting.
Again, can I just say, I'm so impressed by Ben Stiller. Like, he's always been, like, for a long time, he was this kind of, you know, crazy comedian guy that made these comedy movies. But even when he was doing those, when he started directing films, he started to get the sense that there was this, like, underlying current of, like, something darker. Like, all of his movies kind of had this sort of dark, seedy underbelly. I just kind of love it. I really, really do. I appreciate him so much.
The Cable Guy is an incredibly dark movie.
Yes.
And I think people were very off put by that when it came out, and it's kind of had like a little bit of like a reassessment from people because it was like Jim Carrey at the height of his Jim Carrey-ness, and people wanted goofy comedy, and that movie is a very dark thriller underneath, you know, its lighthearted bones.
And yeah, but even something as ridiculous as Dodgeball still has this like kind of like wacky kind of like, this is not, like the fact that they end up wearing like S&M gear because that's what they get in the box. Like, to me, like, that's just, it's both ridiculous and kind of, when you put it into the ball of the Ben Stiller movies, I'm like, okay, clearly there's something here. I don't know. I just, I like the fact that he's kind of like has this dark streak to him that I never saw coming. And I'm like, okay, I appreciate this. So I kind of feel like the internet kind of failed me a little bit. I say a little bit because I'm disappointed that nobody bothered to tell me that this show existed until after it was off the air for months. But the fact that I ended up finding out about it over the internet also kind of, you know, resurrects everything. So the show in question is Kin. This is an AMC Plus series. I don't think it actually aired on AMC. I think it was specifically made for the streaming service. It's the cast is what got me. I saw this cast and I'm like, what the fuck, internet, you failed. So Charlie Cox, Aidan Gillian, Ciarán Hinds, Maria Dowell Kennedy, and Claire Dunn, all star. And it's about it's basically an Irish mob drama. So you have the Kinsella clan, which is led by Aidan Gillen. Charlie Cox has just come out of prison for something that he did for the family. He's trying to get his life back on track, but of course doesn't know anything better, so he gets sucked back into the family life. In the meantime, they have Ciarán Hinds plays the big mob boss in town that they all kind of report to, and they've fucked him over, essentially. And so now there's like, it's revenge. So there's eight episodes in total, and it's just this very intense Irish mob drama. It's not reinventing the wheel. What it does really well is the fucking acting, because, did we just not say who this cast was? The thing that I like the most about this is that it feels a little bit like Sundown, in that the women hold all the power, even though the men are playing all the, are like the chess pieces that are getting moved around the board. The women are the ones making all the decisions, and I fucking love it. And it ends in a really interesting way, with a setup for season two, which I think will be really great. I really like this show a lot. It, like I say, it's not new, but it does what it does really well. Really, really well. And Aidan Gillen is fucking awesome. Just put him in everything. In everything. I'll take him in anything.
Well, and I honestly, I have not heard of this show.
Exactly. Internet either. Fail.
But I was just looking up real quick, and the show is not over. It's getting a season two.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So see, the end of the first season ends on quite a bit of a cliffhanger. Well, no, they do wrap it up. So the story is they do sort of like wrap up all the pieces of the drama that unfolded in the first season, but they leave it in a way that season two should be fairly interesting if they decide to go with it, which I knew that they had. I think the reason I heard about the show is because they had just greenlit a second season. And I think it's worth mentioning, because I'm a big Braun fangirl, worth mentioning, produced by Braun Studios right here in Burnaby, BC. So, hey, bonus. Throwing it out there. So, Kin, worth checking out. It is solid. Thank me later. Let's finish with I did not realize that they had already released Cursed Films Season 2. Talk to me about Jay's new series, because I haven't seen it, and now I feel bad.
We've got three episodes out of the new series so far. Did you see the first series?
I did. So I have it? Full admission. I kind of, Jay Cheel and I have a bit of a relationship. Like when I started podcasting way back in the days of yore, before there were thousands of podcasts, millions of podcasts, we all had kind of had a round table discussion group together. So the film junk guys, we go way back. Okay. So I really like Jay, and I like the work that he does. So I am a bit of a fangirl.
Okay, so I have a little bit of a, what's the best way to describe it? I don't want to say love-hate relationship, but maybe that's accurate with this series, where it's the entire premise of the doc series, which is basically like every episode is like, let's take one film from film history that has like all of this kind of like cursed mythology surrounding it for whatever various reasons, and do a deep dive into, you know, the cursed nature of this film and explore it. And that in and of itself is catnip to me. It's the type of shit that I absolutely love.
Ditto. Ditto.
And there's good and bad that comes along with that, where you get some episodes that are, I think, legitimately good and explore some very interesting stuff. Like the episode from season one on Poltergeist, I thought was really strong because it pokes at this perfect nexus of, let's explore these myths that have surrounded this movie of a couple deaths and other things surrounding the film. Like there was a suggestion that they use like human cadavers in the as the skeletons in the swimming pool, and you know, it's just a myth that have perpetrated. And there was two of the actors from the original Poltergeist died, and one of them was just a medical tragedy that happened midway through shooting Poltergeist 3 with the young girl. And then the other one was the older teenage daughter in the first film who basically got murdered by her abusive boyfriend. And the doc series, I think, does a really good job of exploring these kind of like curses surrounding the film, but also going and saying, hey, this thing that you're calling a curse is just kind of like fucked up shit that happens in the world, and it's only because of, you know, whatever the annals of time that we like relegate this stuff to be being myth. And sometimes it's like disrespect to actual tragedies that occurred in people's lives. And, you know, it's, I think it, at its best, it ends up being a very nuanced look at these things. I think the biggest problem with the series is there's probably not that many films to explore that have actual curses surrounding them, and sometimes it gets a little slim. And even when they do center on a movie, the amount of stories that they can draw out of it to get to a full episode, I think they're kind of stretching a little bit. So some are better than others. And season one was a bit of a mixed bag. Season two, also a little bit of a mixed bag. There's an episode on Rosemary's Baby in which there's some really interesting stuff around Rosemary's Baby, dealing with the fact that everything was sort of moving into a satanic panic era, and the movie was kind of courting that. But also the episode, because there's really not that much to draw from, just goes down a rabbit hole. It's like, now let's just become about the Manson murders for a little while, because that has the connection to Roman Polanski with Sharon Tate getting murdered. And we're just going to live there for a while because we've run out of stuff to talk about Rosemary's Baby with. And so you kind of get that a bit. The most recent episode I saw was about the movie Stalker, Tarkovsky's infamous movie, which there was a lot of stories there I didn't know about that was really interesting, where there's a bunch of people that died after the filming of that movie. And it turns out the reason was because they were filming basically submerged in water that was polluted with chemical runoff. From like decades of Russian manufacturing in the little abandoned town where they were shooting, and they didn't know any better, and they all kind of got lung cancer and died. That's what Tarkovsky died of eventually, was lung cancer. So it ends up just being a tragedy. But with anything that has a certain level of infamy, people will turn it into myth and look for symbolism where there isn't symbolism. And it explores that a bit. So the show is at times really stretching to find something to say, but it's still interesting enough that I'm just like, ooh, new episode. I gotta watch this. You know, and so like it's hit or miss on how good the episodes are. I went back and rewatched all of season one recently before season two came out. And it's like, some of it's good, some of it not so good, but I think it's all a little bit interesting and I kind of dig it.
Yeah, that was the thing with me with season one as well. I thought some of the episodes were much stronger than others, but generally speaking, I really enjoyed them. And a lot of the stories, even some of the ones that I knew about, were really interesting to kind of see again. So there is a sort of appeal to the backstory. I mean, I like making ofs. So the fact that we get an entire season of shows about basically stories behind the making of movies, I'm like, okay, sure, I'll watch that. So I'll catch up with this. Probably not right away. I'll probably wait till there's a few more episodes out, but I will watch it.
Yeah, and Cursed ends up becoming like a very kind of liberally applied label. Like in season one, there's an entire episode on Twilight Zone, the movie, which is entirely about the fact that because of John Landis's poor management, shall we say, or hubris, directly caused the death of Vic Morrow and two kids on set in a helicopter crash. And which is like, goes down in history as one of the worst moments in filmmaking. And, you know, should have ended John Landis's career, and it mostly has ended John Landis's career. He struggled ever since. He's not really directing anymore. His whole job at this point is like show up in documentaries about other films and extol the virtues of genre cinema. But there's no curse there. It's just like a shitty person with too much power did a shitty thing and people paid the price for it. And that's the curse of Twilight Zone, the movie. So it's some of the episodes are just like, here's a shitty thing that happened because people did not do things right. You know, and it's so there's a lot of kind of like in how curse gets used becomes a very kind of broad label, but ends up becoming filmmaking horror stories, more or less.
Exactly.
That have gone down in history.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, we apparently skipping a week made us talk even longer. We're almost at the 2-hour mark. So now is a good time to kind of wrap things up.
Good to me.
You can come on by atcpod.ca for links to all the show notes. Well, everything is timestamped. There are even chapter breaks in your podcast. If you're whatever subscription service you use, there are chapters now. It's a bitch to set up, but man, it makes it so much easier to navigate through the show. So you're welcome,
people. Where else do you get chapter breaks? I mean, come on, honestly.
Right? And again, Ashley, where can folks find you?
People can find me on Twitter at Ashley Lynch.
And you can find me at The Marina on Twitter. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another show. Until next time. Until
then, insert catchphrase here.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.